Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Tina Orcutt. Orcutt is the superintendent of the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls. She is a 17-year veteran of the National Park Service and is deeply committed to protecting the nation's historical and natural treasures. Welcome to the show, Tina.
Hi, thank you.
Now, I want to talk to you about this. You started your career with the National Park Service when you were 17. What got you interested in this?
I did. I started at a very young age. I grew up just outside of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and so I had been coming to the park my whole life. And it's really an interesting twist of fate. My senior year, my guidance counselor found me one morning and said, you know, an opportunity is available at Gettysburg National Military Park. There's this special intake program, and they're looking for someone just like you that's got, you know, your academic interests and some of your strengths and skills. And, you know, what do you think? And so I thought, well, you know, boy, I don't really know much about this. I hadn't thought about this before. And the more I learned, I thought, well, this would be a fantastic opportunity. So, you know, there I was, 17 years old, applying for this job. And I went in and I did my interview. And, you know, I just remember thinking, shake her hand, look her in the eye, you know. And it was fantastic. I had this terrific opportunity. So I started working for the Park Service
graduating
from high school. I was an interpreter, which basically in the National Park Service is somebody that gives information and takes people on tours of the park. So.
Uh-huh. And so you got bitten by the bug
and you've stayed ever since. I fell in love with it.
Well, so you've worked in parks all over the country, the Military Park in Gettysburg, Colonial in Yorktown in Jamestown, Booker T. Washington Monument in Virginia. Tell us about some of your experiences with some of these parks.
Oh, I've had just some really wonderful experiences in these parks, both with visitors and with other staff members. The Park Service is actually, by and large, a pretty close-knit family, and mm-hmm. so you establish some really strong ties with the people you work with, and they're all generally very deeply committed to what it is they're doing, so that makes it a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But I've had, you know, some wonderful opportunities. When I was at Gettysburg, we celebrated the 125th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, and that was just a phenomenal event. Just tens of thousands of people came, and to be able to participate and be on the inside and be able to have an opportunity to talk about that special place to so many people was really a great experience mm-hmm. for me. Mm-hmm. But I've gotten to do all sorts of things. You know, I've worked with children in some parks and gotten to do a vast array of things, from programs for visitors to resource management work out in the field, and it's been great.
Did you enjoy the educational aspect?
I do.
Quite a bit?
Very much. Mm-hmm. When I was at Gettysburg, I did a lot of programs for the public, and then I moved to Colonial, which is Yorktown and Jamestown, Virginia, and there I started doing more education programs for school children, and from there I moved to New Orleans. And I worked as the park's first education specialist there, helping the staff develop all the curriculum-based programs. Because, you know, I really feel that the best way to protect parks is to make people feel connected to them so that they care about them and they want to protect them. And I think one of the best ways to do that is by working with children.
Mm-hmm. Have you camped in some of these parks?
Oh, I've camped in a lot.
Have you done the roughing it thing?
I have. I've camped in a lot of parks. Probably the biggest hike and camp that I've done was the Grand Canyon. I had the pleasure of hiking to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and back. So
wow, that's amazing.
Huh. Yeah,
that's something I've never done.
It was quite a sense of accomplishment to be able to do that.
Uh-huh. Was it scary?
It wasn't scary, but it was really challenging. And I wasn't in as good a shape as I probably should have been. So,
how long did it take?
You know, we took our time going down. We took 2 days. We started on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, and we took 2 days mm-hmm. to hike down to Phantom Ranch. So we did that kind of leisurely, and were able to do like little side hikes. But then we hiked out on the South Kaibab in one day, in the span of, I don't know, maybe 6 hours or so, and. Mm. That was really tough. I learned some valuable lessons about myself and my endurance and mm-hmm. the effects of dehydration.
But
I did it.
that's something a lot of people probably can't say. That's quite something, I think.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of that achievement.
Uh-huh. Your education is in government and politics and American history. How has this education been incorporated into this 17-year career in the parks?
It's, you know, it's been interwoven and interspersed at different times. I went to American University and University of Maryland, and government and politics was my major, but history was certainly a big interest for me. And in particular, I focused on 19th century history, the Civil War, mid-19th century era. And I was working at Gettysburg at the time. I put myself through college by working for the Park Service. So I was able to design some independent studies and take some seminar classes that really tied into the subject matter. And so I was able to, you know, do research and give that to the park while also satisfying these academic requirements. And it was really neat because, you know, I have an opportunity to utilize a lot of that knowledge here at Women's Rights because we talk so much about the mid-19th century history. And, you know, it's amazing how it all connects. As you mentioned, I worked at Booker T. Washington National Monument in Southwest Virginia. Booker T. Washington was born in 1856, and so I've had the opportunity a number of times throughout my career to find these, you know, woven threads that were started in my academic career.
Yeah, history does tie together when you start looking at it. Are you amazed that so many people are still so interested in the Civil War? There are fanatics that are...
It is amazing. It is amazing. Working at Gettysburg was a really significant challenge because of the number of people who are absolute masters of every detail. And so, you know, for me, my particular interest while I was working at Gettysburg, I became more interested in the female civilians, the women of Gettysburg. What were their experiences during the battle and during its aftermath? What were they thinking and feeling and experiencing? So, but your average trivia nut is not so much interested in that. So
They're interested in the battles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The left oblique and the right oblique. So, I mean, it was a real challenge for me to make sure that I was up to par.
So what was it, the daily life for women during that era? I mean, that ties into what you're doing now in some ways.
It does. It does very much.
Were they just pretty much sidelined?
Yes and no. Women were very active. You know, women made sure that households kept running, and they had a very important role in domestic life. They pretty much ran the domestic sphere, and they were very active in religion generally. But in many other ways, they were marginalized. You know, women in the mid-19th century, of course, didn't have the ability to vote, couldn't go to college, couldn't enter into a profession, couldn't necessarily keep their pay or have equal pay for the work that they were doing, you know, couldn't sue for divorce or for custody, couldn't hold a leadership position in a church, unless of course they were Quaker. So their lives were severely limited in, you know, a very large sphere, but they really by and large had control in another sphere.
Yeah, that's been true probably throughout history.
Yeah.
Well, one of the missions of the national parks is to both preserve nature and promote tourism. How do these two ideals fare nowadays?
It can be a difficult balance. You know, the National Park Service is established, of course, to preserve these resources and to protect these sites, but it's also for the enjoyment of the nation and for the future generations of the nation. And that's where the balance gets really tricky, because you want to provide opportunities for people to be able to enjoy those resources, but yet you need to make sure that you do so in a responsible manner so that they're left unimpaired for those future generations. And sometimes that's a really tricky balance to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've noticed in some of the parks in California, which is where I'm from, way too much traffic, way too many cars coming into the parks. I don't know how we're going to preserve them with so much erosion by cars and pollution and so on.
That's
one of my concerns.
It's been said by some that parks get loved to death. You know, one of the things that parks are really looking at is alternate transportation systems. Zion National Park, for instance, has moved to an alternate transportation system. So rather than the roads being clogged by cars and motorhomes, they have this outstanding shuttle system.
What a great idea.
Yeah, and so parks are really trying to look for alternate sources of transportation mm-hmm. so that we can move people around in ways that will satisfy their needs, but will also better protect the resources.
Mm-hmm. So people would be parking their cars in a big parking lot and a shuttle would come and pick them up?
Yeah.
Were people resistant to that, though? People just want to be autonomous, especially when they're out camping, you know?
You know, I think it's probably a mixed bag. I think there are some people who are probably resistant to it, and there are others that embraced it immediately. But I think as long as you try to work hard to make sure that you satisfy people's needs, you know, there's no reason why there can't be a drop-off point at a trailhead. Mm-hmm. You know, so that somebody could go off on a 4-day backcountry hike, but they know that when they get to the other end of the trail, the shuttle will pick them up there, too. Mm-hmm. So,
There must be differences in attitudes from people who are coming there to camp and do recreation and people who are actually there for the historic reasons. Do those two things collide as well?
I don't necessarily find the collision so much in the people that are there to camp and the people that are there to learn about history. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the collision is between the more active types of use. You know, camping is sort of a passive, hiking is kind of passive, you know, learning about history. But it's the folks who want to have very active uses of parks. That's where some of the rub can be. People who are interested in off-road access,
I was gonna bring that up,
snowmobile,
yeah.
That type of thing. Mm-hmm. There can really be some conflict between those types of uses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think so. Now, you know, a lot of listeners know that the National Park Service is governed by the U.S. Department of the Interior, and Gail Norton is the head, appointed by the Bush administration. She was a very controversial choice, as many people know, especially to environmentalists. What have you seen good and bad coming from all these different administrations that you've had to work with through the 17 years you've been in the parks? What have the challenges been?
You know, that's a really interesting question for me because, you know, when I look back at my career, when I first started, you know, I was 17, turning 18 years old. I had no clue about the larger political picture. You know, I just came mm-hmm. in and did my job. And then as I progressed through my career, I started to get a more sophisticated understanding. And certainly as a superintendent, I'm learning even more. You know, administrations all have different agendas. And some are focused more on parks, and some are focused more on other programs. You know, Gail Norton's approach, she really wanted collaboration. She really wanted the parks to work closely with the state park systems and with other entities and really look at it from a partner approach. And mm-hmm. certainly Director Minella is following that mandate closely. It's, you know, very important to her as well. And, you know, so it's always kind of interesting. Everybody kind of comes in and has a different take on things and a different agenda, but that's been really important to Gail Norton and to Fran Minella, that we really work on this seamless network of parks, mm-hmm. which makes sense, you know, because it should really be about the visitor experience and enjoyment, not necessarily about marking turf.
Does Gail Norton have the oversight to actually have people change the way that they're managing different
yes.
parks? And does she really micromanage in that way?
The department pays pretty close attention.
Really? I wouldn't have thought so.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought they'd have time.
Well, you know, the National Park Service is a very popular agency, mm-hmm. and we get a lot mm-hmm. of attention. And so the department pays a fair amount of attention. So, I think the department is very involved, certainly from the budget aspect. The department is very involved, and the department always takes a stance on, you know, whether land, you know, whether they are in support of any kind of land acquisition or if they're opposed. And this particular administration, it's very important to them for us to take care of the resources that we have, mm-hmm. as opposed to trying to acquire any additional resources. So, you know, I think they're probably as involved as any administration that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Do the individual parks ever come together and try to change mandates? Does that ever happen?
Individual parks come together to try to change mandates. You know, I think if sometimes the changes happen because of legal challenges.
Uh-huh.
You know, say
mm-hmm.
a park decides that it needs to make a decision based upon this scientific information, that this impact is occurring. And so the park would go through the public process, do whatever type of NEPA compliance would be necessary, and maybe there'd be a legal challenge. it's those legal challenges that very often will result in some sort of policy change. So sometimes it's the action of parks or the decisions or the proposed actions of parks that will really have an impact on policy. But as for parks coming together to make those changes, I don't think that's generally the way that it happens.
Well, I just try to put it in a small, a small category of like an office being told to suddenly change what you're doing, even though the office itself knows best what the needs are in the community and what people who visit the park want. That was one of the reasons why I was thinking.
Our challenge is really, okay, so this is our mandate. How do we best satisfy this mandate and still meet the needs of the visitor?
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Tina Orcutt. She's the superintendent of the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls. Let's talk about your current position, superintendent of the Women's Rights National Historical Park in Seneca Falls. Well, what do you do as a superintendent?
It's a wonderful job. My responsibility is just to oversee the park, to make sure that we are complying with all of the requirements that we have in terms of how parks are supposed to be managed, but also to make sure that we're meeting the visitors' needs and that we're protecting the park resources. And I think my job is to keep all of the balls up in the air and to make sure that we don't drop any of the really important ones.
Are you involved in the day-to-day welcoming of guests and so on?
Sometimes I am. We're a relatively small staff, and there are times where, we just don't have a lot of staff, and it's actually a lot of fun for me because it's my background. I'll end up working behind the information desk, and I'm fairly competent at the cash register. But other than that, I can do a pretty good job of giving out information, and it's a real treat for me. And, every once in a while, it's great. I'd be out, in the Wesleyan Chapel where the first Women's Rights Convention was held. And some people come over to me, oh, so tell us what happened here. And then I get the opportunity to give them a tour of the chapel. So that's great fun for me. I really like to be able to keep my hand in the day-to-day, and then it allows me to see what's really going on in the park, what are our visitors like, what do they want from us, are they getting what they need, that type of thing.
So you must have been interested in, or quickly got yourself up to speed on the fact that this was the first Women's Rights Convention here and all the particulars in regard to that. Has your interest expanded since you started working there?
Oh, absolutely. I first visited Seneca Falls when I was in college, very early on in my career. And a dear friend, Marilyn Barrow, who's one of the residents of Seneca Falls, said, I got to take you to this park. And so she took me there, and the park was really in its infancy at the time. And I thought, oh my gosh, why haven't I learned anything about this in school? This is a fantastic story. Boy, I would really love to work here one day. And so I kind of always kept my eye on the park as I was sort of moving through my career. And then this opportunity came up when my predecessor moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas. And so, I was very fortunate to be able to get the job. And, then I thought, oh, my gosh, now I really have to get up to speed, because I had a fairly shallow knowledge base about the story. And so fortunately for me, I'm very interested in it. So I like to read about this. So, I could sit around in the evenings and read about the movement. And
I'm glad.
It's a lot to
I'm
learn.
Glad the park's there because a lot of people have a shallow understanding of the particulars in regard to this. Women's history hasn't been that important up until the last 20 years or so, it seems, the park was designated a historical park in 1980, so you guys are coming up upon you're in your 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean when you're designated? What kind of perks or what happens when you're designated?
That's when we're established by law.
Ah.
So it's kind of an interesting story. There was a movement, kind of a groundswell of concerned citizens in Seneca Falls that said, hey, we have some important places here and something very important happened here, and they really wanted to preserve these places and wanted to bring more attention. And about the same time, the Park Service was, it's interesting because if you look at the Park Service and its evolution, what has been deemed nationally significant has sort of evolved. Mm-hmm. You know, it started very narrowly, and then it's gotten a little bit broader and more inclusive. And so the Park Service was said, you know, we need to be looking at sites that are more inclusive of the whole population. And at about that time, you know, we started looking, okay, where are National Historic Landmarks? That's a program that's administered by the National Park Service, but they're not necessarily in national parks. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Cady Stanton's house was a National Historic Landmark, so that's when we said, you know, maybe there's some real merit to exploring the idea of a park in Seneca Falls. And so it was the Park Service and those concerned citizens coming together that really was the impetus for the establishment of the park. And so the legislation was one of the last pieces of legislation that Jimmy Carter signed. I understand with a broken collarbone before he left office. So so we were officially designated, you know, as a national park, and therefore ensuring our long term mm-hmm. protection.
So does the federal government, in its capacity as sort of the caretaker of the parks, do they give you money to keep these places in good shape? And
yes,
it must be a challenge to keep some of this stuff in.
Oh, it's a phenomenal.
People going through them, and
it's a phenomenal challenge. Yeah, we have an annual appropriation that gives us our base operating budget, but it really is. And there's been a fair amount of media attention about that over the last few years. That, you know, the maintenance backlog, as they refer to it. The last park that I worked at was the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal National Historical Park, and we had nearly 1,400 historic structures there.
Wow.
And right along the Potomac River. So, you know, you have to deal with flooding, you have to deal with a lot of use, and then you also have these structures that are quite old.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a phenomenal task. Mm-hmm. To try to maintain all of those.
Yes, so did you go out and inspect? And mm-hmm. are you the one that delivers the messages that, this is starting to look, you know, like it might need some attention?
I actually was, I was the resource manager there. So, yes, I was the one that got to come in and tell the superintendent, yeah, well, we have a significant problem here. And we have, you know, this particular invasive species is really taking over this area of the park. So, yes, I got to be the bearer of bad news in that job.
Yeah, well, it's a good thing because it's the only way these things are probably staying in shape at all, considering how much our culture is into tearing everything down and putting in new stuff that all looks alike in every city, you know. Let's talk about some of the events that are coming up for the coming months, anniversary and so on. What's up?
As you know, we had a big event in July around Convention Days, the anniversary of the First Women's Rights Convention. And that was a lot of fun. We had a big anniversary celebration where the first superintendent of the park came, and a lot of the people who were involved in the early days of the park, they came together, and we had a celebration, and we actually launched an oral history project.
Uh-huh.
And it's really neat. We gave people an opportunity. Our celebration was part Quaker meeting in the sense that these people had an opportunity to stand up and say, you know, here's how I was involved, and here's a story that I remember from those early days. And it was a lot of fun. And we really wanted to capture those, but we realized, you know, we just scraped the surface. And there are a whole lot of people out there who were very much involved and very committed to this park, its establishment, and its development over the years. And so we launched an oral history project. And so that'll be continuing for the next few years as we try to do these oral histories to chronicle this history. You know, so many parks are, you know, 100 years old or older, and it's very difficult to capture that history once it passes. So we have a great opportunity to be able to do that because we're such a young park.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be ongoing. Another event that's coming up on October 1st, we are extremely fortunate at Women's Rights to have a very supportive nonprofit friends group. You know, many parks have friends groups, and they do a variety of different things. This group of people, I mean, talk about talented, dedicated people who really care deeply about this park and these stories. The Friends has been sponsoring an annual program, which by and large they staff and run, called Elizabeth and Me. And it's a really neat program. It's different. You know, it's free, and it's open to girls roughly ages 12 to 16. And 50 to 60 girls come in, and they have the opportunity to learn about the park, to see these sites, to learn about Elizabeth Cady Stanton and the things that influenced her, the choices that she made in her life, the networks of people that she knew, and how she made things happen via those networks, and how she was a leader in her time. And it really gives these girls an opportunity not just to learn about the story and about these people, but to really start to think about themselves and to start to think about the paths that they would like to take in their lives and how they can affect change and the types of networks that they can establish. And so it's a really neat program.
Yeah, it sounds like
Is
it a one-day or is it?
It is. It's a one-day program. It runs, it's about a 6-7 hour program.
Hmm. And that's on October?
It's on October 1st.
October 1st.
Yeah.
Wow, that does sound great. What a nice opportunity for girls
to
see role models.
Yeah, and it's the type of program where girls would need to register ahead of time, and we would also need to get basically permission slips from parents. There are adult chaperones. There are college students that help with this program. The Friends members are very active in it, and then they have some alumni. Girls who participated in the program years ago come back and they help with the program again. Mm. It's a great program.
Oh, that's great. Are there still some, I assume there are still relatives of some of the founding mothers?
There are.
Are they still in the area?
There are a fair number of, it's really interesting the more you dig, the more you find, these connections to other people. There are many descendants from the signers of the Declaration of Sentiments, which was what was debated and what was signed during the first Women's Rights Convention. So there are lots of descendants, but there are some descendants from really the women who were the shakers and movers to make it happen. And I was very fortunate to get to meet Elizabeth Cady Stanton's great-great-granddaughter, Colleen Jenkins, over the course of the 25th anniversary. And just, what a neat lady.
Is she very involved in the park?
She is. She's very involved in the park. She cares deeply about the park. We had some fantastic conversations. I just meet her and she says, so what do you think that you should do with Elizabeth Cady Stanton House? And I thought, oh my gosh, what's the right answer here?
Preserve it.
That was definitely the right answer. So, we just had some talks about, how do you breathe more life into that story, and how do you help to connect people to it? And, she's a very thoughtful, very caring, committed person.
That's
great.
That's wonderful to know, yeah.
It's wonderful to have those people.
Uh-huh. How can people volunteer? What's the stipulation, and how do they get in touch with you? And do they have to do a certain amount of hours a month?
No, we don't really have any requirement for that. The types of volunteers that we're looking for, we really, we need a variety of people. We need... every year, everyone has to live within a budget, right? And every year you have to make decisions about what your priorities and what you're going to be able to do and what you're not going to be able to do. But having some really good volunteers can really help supplement those things. So, we could use people to act as docents, to help to give people tours through our museum, to help give tours of Elizabeth Cady Stanton's house or of the chapel structure. We can use volunteers, people who like to talk to people, who would like to stand behind the information desk and provide orientation and information to visitors. Mm-hmm. But also craftsmen, people that are familiar with historic preservation that would be willing to donate their time to help us do some preservation work on these structures. That would be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And they can certainly contact me at the park, and then I can point them in the right direction as for who the next point of contact would be.
How can they contact you? Do you have a number of website?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, our website is www.nps, as in National Park Service, .gov, and then it's /WORI, for Women's Rights. So that's our website. Our telephone number is 315-568-2991.
Great. We have actually run out of time. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.